The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard, continued. Disc 7.
Not 150 miles to the east, Bellamy was sailing over gentle seas, pushed along toward Cape Cod by a fair wind. The day had gotten off to a fine start. At 9 that morning, while still out of sight of land, they had intercepted a two-masted vessel between Nantucket Shoals and George's Bank, the most productive fishing grounds of southern New England. Bellamy ordered the craft to surrender, emphasizing the point by firing a cannon shot ahead of her bow. Seven of his men rowed over to the prize, the Mary Ann of Dublin, and ordered the captain and most of his crew to row themselves over to the Widder. Bellamy questioned the captain, one Andrew Crumpsley, and was pleased to discover that he had been on his way from Boston to New York with a load of wine. He sent four more crewmen to rustle up some bottles to pass around the Widder and Ann Galley. Unfortunately, they had some trouble getting into Marianne's hold. The heavy anchor cables were piled over the entrance. For now, the men of the Widder would have to settle for the five bottles of fresh wine the pirates had found in Crumpsley's cabin. No matter, they would take the Marianne with them and find time to plunder her later. Between the decks, the pirates' morale was presumably lifted by the prospect of a wine-fueled party on the shores of an out-of-the-way Maine island. First, there would be a short stop on Cape Cod, for after the Mary Ann's capture, Bellamy ordered all three vessels to follow a course of north by northwest. This took them not to the islands of mid-coast Maine, but straight for Provincetown, and by extension, Eastham. According to surviving accounts by those present, Bellamy told his crew they would be stopping on the Cape to stock up on fresh food and provisions. But according to Eastham folklore, his real aim was to reunite with young Miss Hallett and show her and her family just how much he had made of himself. At about 3 in the afternoon, a fog settled around the Widder and her two prizes, so dense and impenetrable that the pirates had trouble keeping the vessels together. Without a pilot for each, Bellamy knew it would be too dangerous to approach the treacherous shores of Cape Cod. If his great ship ran aground on one of the many unmarked shoals, they would be sitting ducks for the Royal Navy or any other armed authority. Despite his desire to get to Provincetown's anchorage, Bellamy ordered the vessels to come to a stop. Their sails flapping idly in the wind, the three vessels bobbed amid the eerie mist, waiting for visibility to improve. Not half an hour later, the pirates had a stroke of luck. Drifting through the fog, straight into their midst, came a small trading sloop, the Fisher, on her way from Virginia to Boston. Clearly, the sloop's captain knew these waters well enough to be willing to traverse them in these conditions. Just the man the pirates needed. Bellamy hailed her, asking whether the master was acquainted here with the coast. The Fisher's captain, Robert Ingalls, replied he knew it very well. Bellamy insisted Ingalls row over to lead the way. By 5 o'clock, Ingalls and his first mate were standing on the Widder's quarterdeck under heavy guard, advising Bellamy on how best to proceed up the long, harbourless shore of the outer cape. Bellamy happily ordered his three prizes to follow the Widder as Ingalls guided her through the fog toward the unseen coast. It would soon be dark as well as foggy, so they placed a large lamp on the stern of each vessel to make it easier for them to keep track of one another. They proceeded to the north. Bellamy and the Widder, with over 130 of the pirates and most of the captives, Noland and 17 pirates in the Ann Galley, the wine-loaded Mary Ann under the control of 8 of Bellamy's men, and the prize crew of 4 pirates guarding captives in the Fisher. Aboard the Mary Ann, 7 of the 8 pirates promptly went for the casks of wine in the hold. Thomas South, one of the carpenters forced from the St. Michael 5 months earlier, remained sullen, quiet, and unarmed, keeping his distance from the rest of the pirates. While the others shoved aside the piled-up anchor cables on top of the hatches, South whispered to one of the Marianne's captive crewmen that he was plotting to escape from the pirates as soon as possible. Meanwhile, the rest of the pirates continued taking turns at the helm, while the others broke open the first barrels of Madeira wine and started what they intended to be a very long night of drinking. It wasn't long before the Marianne began falling behind the rest of the vessels. Bellamy, aboard the Widow, noticed this and slacked off long enough to let the wine-laden Pink catch up. He yelled at the leaders of the Marianne pirates, Simon Van Voorst and John Brown, to make more haste. Brown, already tipsy, swore he would make the vessel carry sail till she carried her masts away. He and the other men ordered their captives to help them handle the sails, and when they realized that the Marianne had a leaky hull, to do the back-breaking work of manning the pumps. They damned the vessel herself, saying they wished they had never seen her. By the time darkness fell, they turned the helm over to one of their captives, freeing up another pirate for the critical task of drinking wine. Brown declared himself captain, while another pirate, Thomas Baker, began bragging to the captives, telling them that their company had a privateering commission from King George himself. "We will stretch it to the world's end," Van Voorst chimed in. At about 10 at night, the weather began turning ugly. Heavy squalls of rain began to fall. The pitch-black sky was shattered by bolts of lightning. Worst of all, the wind had shifted so that it was coming from the southeast and east, driving the vessels toward the unseen shore of Cape Cod. The drunken pirates aboard the Marianne soon lost sight of the other vessels. Baker, perhaps distressed, began cursing the Marianne's cook, Alexander McConaughey, who was manning the helm and had apparently steered her closer to land. He would make no more to shoot him than he would a dog, Baker howled, musket in hand. You will never go on shore to tell your story. Not long thereafter, the shore presented itself as if rebuking Baker. The Marianne was now being battered by 20 to 30 foot seas, which broke in cascades of foam all around her. Everyone realized they might run aground at any moment and be dashed to pieces by the angry sea. McConaughey begged the pirates to swing her around, bow to the beach, to give her the best chance of surviving the inevitable collision with the bottom. No sooner had they swung around than the Marianne struck, shaking the hull violently and sending wine casks tumbling about the decks. Baker grabbed an axe and began hacking away at her masts, as bringing them down would reduce the stress on the creaking hull. With two of the three masts down, another of the pirates cried out in terror, "For God's sake, let us go down into the hold and die together." The men, captives and pirates alike, huddled on deck and in the hold, expecting to be drowned at any moment. The illiterate pirates begged McConaughey to read from the Book of Common Prayer. As they listened to the prayers in the cook's Gaelic accent, lightning flashed in the sky, wind screamed through the rigging, and the wooden hull shuddered in the surf. The crews of the other prize vessels were more sober and possibly, as a result, more fortunate. As the storm built, Richard Noland in the Anne Galley lost sight of the Widow's lantern, but he kept close to the little fisher. The mountainous waves were pushing them toward the breakers, which they could hear crashing on the Cape's deserted shore. Noland realized their only chance was to drop their anchors and hope that the great iron hooks held firm enough to keep them off the beach until the storm subsided. He swung the Anne around, and the men flung the anchors overboard. He screamed and gesticulated to the fisher to do the same. On both vessels, pirates and captives alike watched anxiously as the anchor cables played out, stiffened, and miraculously pulled the wooden ships to a stop a few hundred yards off the beach. If prayers were said during the night, they were undoubtedly directed at the anchors, clinging to the sandy bottom as the Atlantic vented its fury. A few miles to the north, the Widow was also being driven inexorably toward shore. As the huge seas tossed the ship closer and closer to the crashing surf, Sam Bellamy may well have remembered the wrecks of the Spanish treasure fleet, great hulls battered into kindling by violent, storm-driven surf. Bellamy knew where he was. In flashes of lightning, he could see the great cliffs of Eastham looming 100 feet above the exploding waves. If they crashed here, there would be few survivors. The surf washed nearly to the feet of the cliffs, which rose precipitously to the tablelands, that windswept, sparsely inhabited plain separating the villagers of Eastham and Billingsgate from the sea. By midnight, he knew the widow's half-ton anchors were the only hope of saving her. The men struggled to follow the order as waves rolled over the deck. The helmsmen, their feet wide apart, spun the wheel, bringing the great ship's bow face to face with the wind. The anchors splashed into the water, and their heavy ropes began to play out. Everyone held their breath as the lines grew taut. There may have been a moment's pause as the widow briefly stopped drifting toward the foamy chaos behind them, but then they could feel the anchors dragging. The widow was doomed. There was one last chance to save the crew, to do just as the men on the Mary Ann had done. They had to try to bring the vessel ashore gracefully, bow first, hopefully making it far enough through the violently tossing surf to give a swimmer some hope of getting ashore. Bellamy yelled out to the men to cut the anchor cables. As soon as the last strokes of their axes had fallen, the thick anchor rope snapping free, Bellamy ordered the helmsman to swing her all the way back around, to run face first into the beach. But the vessel didn't turn. All watched in terror as the ship slipped backward, stern first, over 30-foot waves toward the white, misty chaos at the foot of the cliffs. The widow ran aground with shocking force. The jolt likely shot any men in the rigging out into the deadly surf, where they were alternately pounded against the sea bottom, then sucked back away from the beach by the undertow. Cannon broke free from their tackles and careened across the lower decks, crushing everyone in their path. One pirate was thrown across the deck so hard his shoulder bone became completely embedded in the handle of a pewter teapot. Little John King, the 9-year-old pirate volunteer, was crushed between decks, still wearing the silk stockings and expensive leather shoes his mother had dressed him in aboard the Bonetta months earlier. Within 15 minutes, the violent motion of the surf brought the widow's mainmast crashing down over the side. Waves broke over the decks, and water poured into the bedlam of crashing cannon and barrels of cargo below decks. At dawn, the widow's hull broke apart, casting both the living and dead into the surf. As the storm raged on through the morning hours, the ebbing tide left more and more bodies piled on the shore. Amidst the bloated, mangled corpses, only 2 men stirred. One was John Julian, the Mosquito Indian who had served with Bellamy aboard his periaguas. The other was Thomas Davis, one of the carpenters forced from the St. Michael. Samuel Bellamy and some 160 other men, pirates and captives, whites, blacks, and Indians, had perished in the storm. 10 miles to the south, the pirates aboard the Mary Ann were thankful to be alive. At daybreak, they could see they had run aground on a half-drowned island in the middle of a small, protected bay. The crew of the Mary Ann probably recognized the place, Pochet Island, south of Eastham. With the tide down, half of the Mary Ann lay high and dry against the island, and the men could get ashore without getting their feet wet. They tarried about on the beach for several hours, eating sweetmeats and drinking more wine. At about 10 a.m, 2 local men who had noticed the wrecked vessel rowed over in a canoe and brought the castaways to the mainland. The locals, John Cole and William Smith, apparently weren't suspicious, even when the pirates got into heated discussions in a mix of English, French, and Dutch. They could overhear that a number of the shipwrecked sailors wanted to get to Rhode Island as fast as possible, presumably to seek shelter among Williams's people. The others seemed more subdued, sitting quietly by the fire in John Cole's home until, all of a sudden, one of them spoke up. This was Alexander McConaughey, who blurted out that the other eight were ruthless pirates, members of Black Sam Bellamy's infamous company. The pirates knew it was time to go. They took their leave of the flabbergasted family of John Cole and scurried out into the rain. They got as far as the East Ham Tavern before Justice of the Peace John Doan and his men caught up with them. Alerted by John Cole, Doan headed straight for the tavern, one of the few places where strangers might procure horses. Soon Doan had all the Marianne's complement, pirates and captives alike, under armed guard, walking down the muddy road toward the Barnstable jail. The pirates aboard the Anne Galley and the Fisher were luckier than the rest. Through good fortune, or perhaps by dint of the lightness of their vessels, their anchors held through the night. At 10 in the morning, the rain still coming down in sheets, the wind shifted back to the west, blowing away from the land rather than into it. With great relief, Noland ordered the sails and anchors raised. With the wind at their backs, they sailed away from the surf, bound for the coast of Maine, where they hoped to find the widow and her store of treasure. 10 miles out, Noland decided it was time to rid themselves of the Fisher. The pirates transferred all of the crew and valuables aboard the Anne and left the Fisher floating in the open sea, crewless, and with hatches open to the storm. 2 days later, on April 29th, the Anne dropped anchor in the lee of Monhegan Island, a high, rocky island 10 miles off the coast of Maine. Monhegan had been inhabited by Englishmen on and off since 1614, and was the site of one of New England's first year-round fishing stations. But on that blustery day in 1717, there may not have been anyone on the island to greet the pirates. The majority of Maine settlements had been destroyed by Wabanaki Indians, who were allied with the French. The central and eastern portions of the coast were still contested by France and Britain, including Monhegan and other offshore islands like Damaris Cove and Matinicus. Monhegan had a water supply and easy access to some of the best cod fishing grounds in the Americas. It might lack a cozy harbor, but for outlaws on the run, it was a safe place to linger and wait for the widow, Marianne, and Marianne to arrive. Days passed with no sign of them. Noland and the other men began to fear the worst, that they were all that remained of the greatest pirate fleet in the Americas. Thomas Davis, one of the two survivors of the widow wreck, had dragged himself out of the surf and, shivering and exhausted, stumbled through the darkness in search of shelter. He trod down the beach a short way, pelted with rain, impassable cliffs of sand hemming him in against the sea. Illuminated by flashes of lightning, the wall of sand appeared to go on forever in both directions. There was only one way to escape. Davis began to climb. Fortunately, he was a young man, 22, and presumably in good health, for despite cold and exhaustion, he somehow managed to reach the top of the 100-foot wall of sand. He must have rested a bit at the summit. An eerie plain of grass stretched out before him in the mist. Behind him, down in the surf, the shattered remains of the widow flashed in the lightning like a ghostly apparition. Finally, he stumbled forward, shivering in the wind and rain, away from the sea. At 5 in the morning, Davis finally arrived at the farm of Samuel Harding, 2 miles from the wreck site. In some form, Davis related his story to the East Ham native. Harding's ears must have pricked up when he heard of the shipwreck, for almost immediately he retrieved his horse. Davis, half drowned, found himself stuck on its back and led to the beach by the farmer. Harding circled the cliffs and, guided by Davis, proceeded to the wreck site. The two halves of the widow had separated by now, battered further and further apart by the storm, and bits and pieces of the ship, her cargo, and crew were spreading along the base of the cliff. They lashed anything of value to the horse and, fully loaded, proceeded back to Harding's farmhouse. Harding immediately turned around and repeated the trip multiple times through the early morning hours. By 10 in the morning, Harding was joined by his brother, Abiah, neighbors Edward Knowles and Jonathan Cole, and some 7 other men, scooping up valuables as quickly as possible, knowing the authorities could arrive at any time. Jonathan was the son of John Cole, one of the 2 men who rode out to rescue the Mary Ann pirates that morning, 10 miles to the south. They may have picked through the increasing number of storm-battered corpses piling up on the beach, more than 50 by that afternoon, relieving the dead of silver buttons and buckles, jewelry, and coins. As it turned out, they had plenty of time. Eastham's justice of the peace, Joseph Doan, was tied up for the entire day, intercepting and arresting the Mary Ann's crew on the other side of town and escorting them to Barnstable. Doan didn't make it to the wreck site until the following morning, Sunday the 28th, at which point he found all was gone of value. Doan later claimed he then commanded the inhabitants of the area to save what they could for the king, while the local coroner, Jonathan Cole's father-in-law, oversaw the burial of 62 drowned men, collecting several things belonging to the wreck in the process. The total value of the items set aside for the king came to only £200, suggesting that many thousands of pounds of valuables made their way into the hands of the good people of Eastham. It could hardly have been otherwise. Within a couple of days, 200 people, most of the able-bodied inhabitants of the town, were out plundering the wreck, cutting up bits of sail and taking riches out of the sand. A strange occurrence was later reported to authorities sent in from Boston. On Monday the 29th, less than 3 days after the Widow wrecked, a very great sloop arrived off the beach. The mysterious vessel approached the largest piece of the Widow, then lowered a boat into the water. A number of its crewmen rowed over and examined the weather-battered remains. She chased off several local fishing vessels before sailing off into the open sea. Colonial authorities assumed it to have been the Widow's consort, an error they passed on to history. On April 29th, Palsgrave Williams was 140 miles to the southeast, cruising for prizes near the entrance to Long Island Sound, still unaware of the Widow's destruction. The day before, his company had plundered a sloop from Connecticut, taking 3 bushels of salt and 2 of their sailors. One of the sailors, Edward Sargent, knew the immediate area well and was forced to act as their pilot, as they lurked in the waters between Montauk and Martha's Vineyard. Unfortunately, no captures came their way that day and for several days after that, causing much dissatisfaction among the crew. On May 3rd, near the desolate island called No Man's Land, south of Martha's Vineyard, they took 2 trading sloops inbound from North Carolina. From the Hannah and Mary, they seized items to help in the overhaul of the Marianne, and a Devonshire man living in Boston who could guide them safely around Cape Cod and on to Maine. The second sloop, a smaller vessel from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, had nothing of value. Such paltry pickings could not have mollified the crew. Grumbling undoubtedly continued as the Marianne failed to catch any worthwhile prizes. Another week passed, then 2, all without plunder. At this point, they cruised directly for Maine, where they hoped to find Bellamy and the Widow. A trusted commander and an unstoppable ship would set things right. Guided by her captive pilot, the Marianne stayed well offshore of Cape Cod on a course set straight for Cape Elizabeth, a prominent headland in southern Maine that could be seen for miles out at sea. They had no way of knowing that at that very moment, the Widow lay scattered in the surf just over the western horizon. At noon on May 17, 1717, some 75 miles offshore, they intercepted a fishing sloop, the Elizabeth, bound from Salem, Massachusetts, to the great cod fishing grounds of George's Bank. There was no gold on this paltry prize, of course, just 16 huge barrels filled with salt, bait, and food. The sloop was tiny, but Williams thought it to be about the right size to help careen the Marianne when they finally found their way to Damaris Cove. The pirates forced the Elizabeth's skipper to come aboard, putting some of their own number on the fishing sloop, and continued on to Maine. After daybreak on Sunday the 18th, Williams's men spotted the bold outline of Cape Elizabeth. Their pilot, not knowing the way to Damaris Cove, the pirates decided to sail the Marianne straight to the nearest harbor to kidnap a local mariner. In a few hours, they came to anchor between Cape Elizabeth and Richmond Island, where the docks and associated detritus of a 70-year-old fishing station stared blankly out at them. The station's fishermen were long gone, but there was a farmhouse on the mainland shore, a small sloop anchored in the harbor, and an open boat or two pulled up on the seaweed-strewn beach. Certainly, Williams reasoned, a pilot could be found here. Up at the farmhouse, Dominicus Jordan could smell trouble. He had been born on the shores of the little anchorage, but had seen more warfare and violence than most pirates. At the start of the War of Spanish Succession, a band of Indians had occupied his parents' fortified home. Dominicus's father, a giant of a man with a fearsome reputation, put a hatchet through an Indian's head. The other Indians killed the father and carried 19-year-old Dominicus, his mother, and 5 younger siblings into captivity in the Canadian wilderness. The family spent the next 13 years with the Indians, learning their language and many of their ways, before being released in 1715. Dominicus took one look at the heavily manned sloop of war and knew enough to get away. He grabbed his wife and 3-year-old son and, with the servants, fled into the woods. Williams's men spent the day and night at Cape Elizabeth, rifling through the Jordan's possessions. At one point, the pirates detained a hapless fishing boat that had entered the anchorage. One of the fishermen admitted knowing the way to Damaris Cove and Monhegan, and was pressed into service as a pilot. His young assistant was set free ashore and ran through the woods to alert the nearest town, Falmouth, of the pirates' presence. That afternoon, they sailed 30 miles eastward to Damaris Cove Island, off what is now Booth Bay Harbor. A long, rocky island with a snug cove nestled in its southern end, Damaris Cove had been a rendezvous for fishermen for more than a century. Following the devastation of the Indian Wars, the island was unoccupied, apart perhaps from occasional visits by fishermen needing a place to sleep after a long day spent pulling 4- and 5-foot-long codfish up from the cold waters of the Gulf of Maine. Anchored securely in the cove, the tops of the Marianne's masts were nearly hidden from view by the brambly ridges that rose from each side. It was, indeed, a safe place to hide out, rest, and repair the sloop. Of the widow, however, there was not a sign that she'd ever graced the island with her presence. Williams stayed at Damaris Cove for 5 days, vainly hoping that Bellamy would suddenly appear, ship and treasure intact. He did his best to get the Marianne into shape, unloading her cargo, taking out her broken mast, and careening the underside of her hull. Those not at work gathered at the gravelly beach at the head of the cove, grimly taking stock of their paltry treasure hoard. 10 cannon, some bales of wool and linen cloth, a bit of scavenged iron, some barrels of food, salt, and water. As the days passed and it became clearer that the widow was not coming, the image of the great heap of gold and jewels piled in her hold must have haunted the weary men. Though they were but 15 miles from Monhegan, Williams's company apparently never encountered their fellow pirates on the Anne Galley and the Fisher. Like the crew of the Marianne, Noland and company had tarried on the outer islands of mid-coast Maine for a time, repairing their vessels and plundering the little fishing vessels that came across their path. These pirates, intimately aware of the dangers the storm had presented to the Whydah, had probably already given up hope and headed south for the safety of the Bahamas. On May 23rd, Williams, too, was forced to accept that his friend had missed their rendezvous. With a sense of foreboding, the crew voted to start the long, dangerous trip back to Nassau. They sailed south to Cape Elizabeth, where they released the Elizabeth and the other fishing vessels, then set course for Cape Cod. In the late morning of the 25th, within sight of the tip of Cape Cod, Williams's men finally learned of the Whydah's fate. The bearer of the ill news was Samuel Skinner, master of the schooner Swallow of Salem, Massachusetts, whom the pirates detained just inside Massachusetts Bay. The destruction of the Whydah was by now on everybody's lips, from Portsmouth to Newport and beyond, Skinner could have told them, carried in the pages of the Boston newsletter. The Whydah, the treasure, and Williams's friend and accomplice were all gone, destroyed by the sea itself. Williams, presumably reeling from the news, released the Swallow and sailed out of the bay. In Boston, the greatest city on the British American mainland, the destruction of the Whydah had brought little solace. Every few days, another ship arrived in New England's ports bearing tales of pirate attacks. Fishing boats in Maine and the open Gulf, trading sloops off Connecticut, Rhode Island, Martha's Vineyard, and the Cape. For the first time since the outbreak of piracy, nowhere in New England waters seemed safe for men of the black flag. Massachusetts Governor Samuel Shute put the colony on a wartime footing. Unable to trust the safety of the sea lanes, he ordered the 9 surviving pirates transported overland from Barnstable to Boston, under a strong guard and sufficiently bound, from county to county and sheriff to sheriff. For the first few days after the wreck, Boston remained without naval protection. Even after May 2nd, when the fifth-rate frigate HMS Rose finally arrived from the West Indies, Shute remained concerned about the safety of commerce. On the 9th, he dispatched the frigate to Cape Cod, where she spent nearly 3 weeks patrolling for pirates, including a day spent off the wreck site itself. News of the Marianne's landings at Cape Elizabeth reached the governor on May 21st and unnerved him sufficiently to order a week-long closure of Boston Harbor. He armed a sloop, the Mary Free Love, and sent her out as a privateer to hunt down Williams and Noland. He even allowed the captain of the Rose to press 20 of Boston's men to be sure he wasn't overwhelmed by pirates while patrolling the coast. All of New England stood on a knife's edge. Nobody was in a greater state of fear than the captive pirates themselves. They had arrived in Boston on May 4th, were marched up the hill past the townhouse, and then dumped in the cages of Boston's decrepit prison. In addition to the 7 men from the Mary Ann, the prisoners included Thomas Davis and John Julian, who had been apprehended by Justice Doane before they had gotten far from the beach. Soon afterward, Julian was separated from the rest, destined by dint of his dark skin for the slave market. It's possible that John Julian became a slave to the family of a future president, John Quincy Adams. The other 8 prisoners may have wished for the first time that they weren't white, because unless some of their colleagues came into Boston to free them, they all knew they were likely to die on the gallows. Maybe they hoped, as they lay in their cages, that their brethren back in the Bahamas had heard of their fate and were coming to the rescue. Chapter 8. Blackbeard, May to December, 1717. When Blackbeard and Hornigold returned to the Bahamas from the Spanish Main in possession of the Bonnet, a fine sloop of war, and £100,000 in plunder, their reputations soared. Hornigold was now an undisputed leader of the Pirate Republic, taking his place alongside his rival, Henry Jennings. Blackbeard, who was 37 at this time, was regarded as one of the finest captains in the archipelago, brave and effective. Unlike Bellamy, Blackbeard had no intention of pushing his commodore aside, especially given that Hornigold had become less reluctant to take English vessels. Word had gotten around that young Sam Bellamy had captured a ship of force and taken her north to intercept those colonies' spring shipments from Europe and the Caribbean. Several other pirate companies were preparing to follow suit and were busy loading their sloops with the necessary supplies. The French pirate, Olivier Labuse, was back in Nassau and had acquired a powerful ship of his own that at 250 tons and with 20 guns was nearly as strong as the Witta. The Frenchman was busy recruiting additional crewmen. When he got to 150, he intended to cruise to New England, reconnoiter with Bellamy, and continue on as far as Nova Scotia and Newfoundland. Jennings, however, had no interest in sailing north. Alone among the pirate captains, he continued to refuse to attack British vessels, the only sort one could expect to encounter with any regularity there. Charles Vane, for his part, also appeared to have no interest in cruising to cooler climes. Like many of Jennings's company, he seemed content to enjoy his wealth and freedom on shore. After a short break, during which time Hornigold refit the Bonnet into a proper sloop of war, Blackbeard and Hornigold left to cruise, though they stayed much closer to home. In early July, they lurked off eastern Cuba in their respective sloops, hoping to intercept some well-laden transatlantic ships. Instead, they took a sloop under one Captain Bishop, bound from Havana to New York with a cargo of flour. It wasn't gold, true, but flour was always in demand in the Bahamas, where the pirates grossly outnumbered the few remaining farmers. They took the time to transfer 120 barrels of the stuff on board their own sloops before letting Captain Bishop continue on his way. A week or so later, a bit to the west, they captured another New York-bound trading vessel under a Captain Thurber, several days out of Jamaica. The pirates found nothing of interest aboard her apart from a few gallons of rum, which they absconded with before releasing the vessel. Slim pickings, the pirate company must have thought. Perhaps they should be following their colleagues northward after all. By August, Thatch and Hornigold were back in Nassau, their flour ensuring that nobody would want for bread for many months to come. They presumably spent the next few days unloading this cargo and preparing for a longer expedition up the eastern seaboard. Their brethren seemed nearly invulnerable, their control of the sea lanes from Jamaica to New York virtually uncontested by any authority. As they shared intelligence, gathered from captives and the merchants of Harbor Island with the other pirate captains, they concluded that the Royal Navy was helpless to stop them. The HMS Shoreham had only recently returned to Virginia and was said to be in such poor condition that her captain didn't dare leave the protection of Chesapeake Bay. Sam Bellamy's men had so terrorized the British Leeward Islands that the mere rumor of their return had caused the colony's governor to abandon a tour aboard the HMS Seaford for fear he would be captured. Out on Barbados, the Scarborough's crew was said to be all but incapacitated by disease. Outside of Jamaica, that left but two or three ships to protect thousands of miles of coastline from Barbados to Maine. There were rumors that reinforcements were on their way from England, but for the time being, it seemed, the Americas belonged to them. Some of the pirates, particularly Scotsmen and ex-Governor Hamilton's privateers, had started expressing wider aspirations. These individuals loathed King George and had been frustrated by the failure of the 1715 Jacobite rebellion against him. Feeling their power, these pro-Stuart pirates discussed volunteering their services to the pretender, the would-be Stuart king, James III, who was living again in exile in France. This faction, which probably included Jennings, Vane, and a number of Blackbeard's and Williams's men, were developing contacts with Jacobite sympathizers in England, through whom they hoped to one day secure privateering commissions from the Stuart king. The ragtag Republic of Pirates was ready to take a place on the world stage and to take sides in the great geopolitical struggle of the time. Then, bad news came. The Marianne, her sails ragged and her mast jury-rigged, limped into Nassau Harbor, followed by the storm-damaged Anne Galley under Richard Noland. Palsgrave Williams could be seen on the Marianne's quarterdeck, but Sam Bellamy, his inseparable companion, was nowhere to be seen. Williams and Noland related the tragic news of the widow's destruction, how 9 survivors were said to be awaiting trial in Boston with little hope of acquittal, and that Bellamy was not among them. The governors of Massachusetts and Rhode Island had outfitted at least 3 privateers to hunt Williams down, forcing the pirates out of New England waters. Williams had continued plundering vessels as he worked his way down the coasts of New Jersey, Delaware, and the Carolinas, scoring enough wine and provisions to keep his men alive. Through death or desertion, his company was down to just over 30 men. Noland, who he had reunited with along the way, had some 20 men aboard. Of the 125 or more pirates who had left the southern Bahamas with Bellamy early that spring, only 50 remained. Blackbeard was particularly incensed by the news. His friend Bellamy was dead, and the pious fools in Boston were bent on executing the last of the survivors. This could not be allowed to happen. And if it did, Blackbeard would exact a terrible revenge on the people of New England. While conversing with Williams and Noland, he contemplated the possibility of attacking Boston and breaking the captives out of its aging prison. To carry out such a bold plan, Blackbeard would need his own ship of force. At the end of August, an unfamiliar vessel entered the harbor, her sails and rigging frayed, her decks scarred with the telltale wounds of a prolonged battle. She was a sloop of war flying the black flag, but nobody in Nassau had ever seen her before. When her captain showed himself, onlookers were aghast. Clad in a fine dressing gown, his body patched with bandages, was a plump gentleman who looked as if he'd hardly spent a day at sea in his life. None of the people who saw this genteel landsman hobble across the deck would ever have imagined that he was destined to become Blackbeard's leading accomplice. Stede Bonnet, the man in the dressing gown, was the most unlikely of pirates. He had been born on Barbados 29 years earlier, in 1688, to an affluent family of sugar planters. The English had settled Barbados in the late 1620s, a generation earlier than Jamaica or the Bahamas, and Stede's great-grandfather, Thomas, had been among its pioneers. In the 9 decades since then, the Bonnets had cleared hundreds of acres of lowland jungle to the southeast of the colony's capital, Bridgetown, planting it first with tobacco and, more successfully, with sugarcane. Like other successful planters, they had purchased African slaves to tend the crops and the sweltering tubs of cane syrup in the sugar houses. By the time of Stede's birth, the Bonnets had one of the most prosperous estates on the island, 400 acres of sugar, with 2 windmills and a cattle-operated mill to grind the syrup from the cane. Stede's early years were spent on the sprawling plantation, his family attended to by 3 servants and 94 slaves. His life was not without tragedy. In 1694, when he was just 6 years old, his father died, and his mother appears to have died not long thereafter. The estate was placed in the care of his guardians until he came of age. He became an orphan child with a small army of servants and slaves. Bonnet was groomed to take his place among the Barbadian aristocracy. He received a liberal education, served as a major in the island's militia, and courted the daughter of another leading planter, William Allenby. In 1709, when Bonnet was 21, he and young Mary Allenby were married in Bridgetown's St. Michael's Church, a stone's throw from the sparkling surface of Carlisle Bay. They set up house just south of Bridgetown Harbor, where Bonnet was generally esteemed and honored. Then everything began to go wrong. Their first child, Allenby Bonnet, died in early childhood. This had a lasting impact on Bonnet. Three more children followed, Edward, Steed Jr., and Mary. Yet Bonnet's spirits did not rise. He fell into depression, even insanity. His friends felt he suffered from a disorder in his mind, which had been but too visible in him for some time, and which was supposedly caused by some discomforts he found in a married state. Toward the end of 1716, he reached a breaking point. His fellow planters were in an uproar over the depredations of Bellamy and Williams, who had caused much damage to the trade of the nearby Leeward Islands. Bonnet became enchanted. Though he was a landsman through and through, and entirely unversed in the arts of seamanship and navigation, he decided to build himself his own warship. He contracted a local yard to build a 60-ton sloop of war, capable of carrying 10 cannon and 70 or more men. He must have told the authorities that he intended to use it as a privateer, claiming he intended to go to Antigua or Jamaica, where he might expect to be granted a commission to hunt down the pirates. In reality, he wished to become one himself. When the sloop was completed, Bonnet christened her the Revenge and set about hiring a crew. Betraying his ignorance of privateer and pirate custom alike, he paid the men a cash salary instead of shares. He would have to pay his officers well, as he would be entirely reliant on them to operate his vessel. The crewmen may have had political reasons for joining the eccentric planter. They included an unusually large number of Scotsmen, and in the months to come, some of them would express Jacobite proclivities. While the officers set about ordering appropriate arms, stores, and provisions, Bonnet concentrated on the matter he thought most important to successful buccaneering, equipping his cabin with an extensive library. One night in the late spring of 1717, he boarded the Revenge and ordered his hired hands to make ready for departure. Under cover of darkness, the sloop sailed out of Carlisle Bay, leaving Bonnet's wife behind with his infant daughter and young sons, aged 3 and 4. He would never see any of them again. Fearing perhaps he would be recognized in the Leeward Islands, Bonnet ordered his quartermaster to take the Revenge straight to the North American mainland. His hirelings told him he could expect to find ample prizes at the approaches to Charleston, South Carolina. Presumably, nobody would recognize Bonnet there, but on the way he told his crew to refer to him as Captain Edwards, just in case. Though separated by 1,900 miles of ocean and islands, Barbados and Charleston were remarkably alike. Charleston had been founded less than 50 years earlier by a group of Barbadian planters who had successfully replicated their West Indian Slave Society in the coastal swamps of Southern Carolina. A compact, walled city of 3,000, Charleston's streets and low, swampy shoreline were lined with Barbadian-style homes, high-ceilinged frame structures with large windows, balconies, and tiled roofs. Outside the walls, rice and sugar plantations spread for miles up and down the Ashley and Cooper Rivers, their sweltering fields tended by armies of black slaves, overseen by a handful of armed whites. As in Barbados, the colony's whites were outnumbered by their slaves, in this case by a ratio of 2 to 1. By land, the town was entirely isolated from the rest of English America, all communication taking place by sea. South Carolina was effectively a West Indian slave island, stranded on the swampy shores of North America. Charleston, the only proper town in all of South Carolina, was particularly vulnerable to naval attack. It was located on a peninsula at the confluence of two rivers, 5 miles from the sea. The entrance to this estuary was partially blocked by a long sandbar, and 3 pilots were kept busy guiding vessels over it as they passed to and from the ocean. The coast itself, where thousands of mosquitoes and other troublesome insects were tormenting both man and beast, was sparsely populated. Adjacent North Carolina was barely governed at all, there being only a handful of villages and fewer than 10,000 impoverished souls scattered over thousands of square miles of swampy, slow-moving creeks and bayous between Charleston and the Capes of Virginia. For a pirate, this was a perfect setup. They could patrol the entrance of the bar spider-like, collecting all vessels in their web. When the time came to find a refuge to plunder the vessels and evade the law, there were hundreds of miles of creeks, inlets, and islands on the North Carolina coast to hide among, places with entrances too shallow or convoluted for a large warship to follow them. For a novice pirate with a powerful vessel, the Carolinas provided a perfect sandbox in which to learn the trade. Bonnet's men guided the Revenge to the outside of the Charleston bar in late August 1717 and waited for their prey. On August 26th, it came in the form of a brigantine under Captain Thomas Porter from Boston. The Revenge, her decks crammed with men and guns, overtook Captain Porter and compelled him to surrender. Bonnet's prize crew was disappointed to find the brigantine devoid of worthwhile plunder, but they held her just the same so that Porter couldn't alert the town to their presence. A few hours later, they spotted a sloop approaching from the south. They closed in on her and rolled out their guns, compelling her prompt surrender. Bonnet ordered the sloop searched while he consulted with her captain. Bonnet had been telling everyone that he was Captain Edwards, but the sloop's captain, Joseph Palmer, was not fooled. He was from Barbados and was probably surprised to find Major Steed Bonnet in command of a pirate sloop. Bonnet, engaged in piracy for less than a day, had already been found out. Palmer's sloop turned out to be carrying a small but valuable cargo of Barbados's primary exports, sugar, rum, and slaves. The Revenge, her hold still nearly full of supplies, couldn't carry more, nor did Bonnet wish to cram slaves aboard his crowded sloop. Bonnet, perhaps advised by his quartermaster, resolved to take control of both vessels and sail to North Carolina to sort things out. A few days later, the Revenge anchored in the slack brown waters of one of that colony's inlets, probably on Cape Fear, a famous refuge of the buccaneers and corsairs of the previous century. They unloaded Palmer's sloop, and after using it to careen the Revenge, set her on fire. Palmer, along with his crew and slaves, was put aboard Porter's brigantine, which the pirates relieved of anchors and most of her sails and rigging. By reducing her means of propulsion, the pirates intended to give themselves a long head start, delaying Porter's ability to get to Charleston and sound the alarm. They may have overdone it. The brigantine was so slow that Porter was forced to put most of the slaves ashore, else they would have all been starved for want of provisions. South Carolina wasn't to learn of Bonnet's piracies until September 22nd, 4 weeks after they had taken place. By then, he was long gone. The Major was no sailor, a historian would write of Bonnet a few years later, and therefore was obliged to yield to many things that were imposed on him, for want of competent knowledge in maritime affairs. The first such imposition took place as the Revenge sailed out of her North Carolina refuge. Bonnet was already beginning to lose his grip on the crew, who argued openly about where they should cruise next. Ultimately, amid nothing but confusion, They sailed south into the Straits of Florida, perhaps wishing to try their luck fishing the famed Spanish wrecks. Instead, somewhere off Cuba or Florida, they blundered into a situation that nearly cost Bonnet his life. Savvy pirates knew better than to engage a ship far more powerful than them, and could tell a lumbering merchant ship from a deadly man-of-war. Stede Bonnet lacked these skills. Through hubris, weakness, or incompetence, he allowed the Revenge to engage in a full-fledged battle with a Spanish warship. By the time his crew managed to effect a retreat, the Revenge's decks were awash with blood. More than half his crew, 30 to 40 men, was dead or wounded, and Bonnet himself had suffered a severe, life-threatening injury. The Revenge escaped, probably because she was faster and more agile than the Spanish man of war, suggesting that Bonnet could have avoided the incident altogether. As Bonnet lay in his cabin among his books, racked with pain, the crew set a course for the ultimate sanctuary, New Providence Island, and the fabled pirate base at Nassau. The pirates of Nassau listened attentively to Bonnet's story and those of his men. In the discussions that followed, the pirates resolved to grant the eccentric planter refuge, at least until he recovered from his appreciable wounds. In exchange, however, they wished to make use of his fine sloop of war. Blackbeard, Benjamin Hornigold maintained, could do big things if placed in charge of the Revenge, which was far superior to the sloop he had been using. Bonnet, who was barely able to leave his bed, could continue to occupy the captain's cabin, but Blackbeard would be in charge of the ship. Bonnet, now suffering from both mental and physical pain, was hardly in a position to refuse. Blackbeard transferred many of his men and 2 cannon over to the Revenge and commenced repairs on the newly built sloop of war. Within a week or two, he was ready to depart, the Revenge now equipped with 12 guns and 150 men, among them Hornigold's longtime quartermaster, William Howard. Hornigold had business to attend to, but first he may have arranged to meet Blackbeard off the coast of Virginia in a few weeks' time. In the middle of September, Blackbeard was sailing up the Gulf Stream in charge of his first independent command. It would be many months before he saw Nassau again. After Blackbeard's departure, Hornigold put his affairs in order. Some of his preparations for his forthcoming cruise were documented, providing a window into a poorly understood aspect of pirate life. He first recruited Richard Noland, quartermaster of the late Sam Bellamy, to serve as his agent at Nassau, making him responsible for recruiting men and keeping an eye on his interests on the island. He then took a large load of plundered cargo aboard his pirate ship, the Bonnet, flour, sugar, and other surplus items, and sailed it up to Harbor Island. There he spent several days trading and visiting with Richard Thompson and the island's other merchants who were growing rich, smuggling pirate goods into Jamaica and Charleston. While on the island, he was surprised to run into Neil Walker, the son of his old nemesis Thomas Walker. The Walkers had apparently decided that if they couldn't suppress the pirates, they might as well make money off them. Neil was busy loading his sloop with barrels of pirated sugar, which members of Hornigold's crew later spotted outside Thomas Walker's new residence in exile on an islet off Abaco. In Harbor Island's snug anchorage, Hornigold also encountered a newcomer to the Bahamas, a French pirate named Jean Bondavet, whose men had already earned a reputation for harshly treating the island's inhabitants. Bondavet, like Hornigold, was preparing for a new pirate cruise, and the two soon found themselves competing for the same resources. His sloop, the Mary Ann, may well have been the Marianne, which Williams and his company would have been happy to sell after their frightening odyssey. If so, this would have irked Hornigold, who was the pirate who had originally captured the sloop 18 months prior. Both captains were trying to buy supplies from Harbor Island's merchants, and each needed a ship's boat and more crewmen, particularly surgeons. Hornigold had taken pity on his captive surgeon, William Howell, and released him some weeks earlier. The poor man, who loathed the pirate life, had been unable to arrange passage off New Providence and lived in constant fear of being pressed by one pirate crew or another. Bondavet somehow got wind of this, perhaps from Hornigold's men, and quietly sent for him in Nassau. Howell was living with the merchant William Pinder, and both men were at home when Bondavet's men rapped on the door. Pinder opened the door to find himself face to face with a gang of cutlass-wielding Frenchmen. They told the merchant that they had come for Howell and a hogshead of rum, and would cut him with cutlass if he did not deliver both. Pinder only had a gallon of rum, which Howell had brought from town, and when he told the pirates so, they became very rude and threatened to drag Howell away that instant. Howell tearfully told Pinder that he would rather choose to go with Hornigold than with these Frenchmen, who deal so hardly with him. Somehow, he and Pinder put them off long enough for Howell to run over to the house where Richard Noland was staying. He begged Noland to recruit him, saying he would rather serve the English than French if he was compelled to make a choice of either. Noland, pitying the man, arranged for his conscription into the Bonnet's crew. Shortly thereafter, Hornigold's quartermaster, John Martin, bundled him into a boat and carried him to Harbor Island, where Hornigold could protect him. At Harbor Island, Bondavet was upset to learn that the surgeon was now aboard the Bonnet. The Frenchman approached Hornigold, demanding Howell be turned over. Hornigold slyly responded that he would be happy to comply, so long as the surgeon agreed. Howell, of course, refused. Bondavet relented, eventually sailing away without the reputed surgeon. Howell remained desperate to escape from the pirates, however, and repeatedly tried to escape, despite being placed under heavy guard. At one point he approached one of the daughters of Richard Thompson, Harbor Island's leading citizen, begging her to hide him. Nobody on the island dared to help the man, Thompson later said, lest Hornigold should burn or destroy their houses or do some other vileness, the whole place being in such fear of Hornigold that no inhabitant dared speak against or contradict any of his orders. When the Bonnet departed the Bahamas to meet Blackbeard, we know Howell was on board, forced into piracy for the second time in less than a year. By this time, Blackbeard and company were 1,000 miles to the north, patrolling the entrance to Delaware Bay, through which all of Philadelphia's commerce passed. During the trip from Nassau, Blackbeard had developed growing doubts about the Revenge's eccentric owner. Bonnet's crewmen told stories that made it clear that the planter, even in health, was entirely unfit for command, not knowing a block from a halyard. Bonnet stuck to his cabin for the most part. When he ventured out on deck, he wore an elegant morning gown and usually carried the book he was reading in his hands. His mental state was similarly fragile, and Blackbeard suspected it would be no great feat to lift permanent control of the Revenge from his tenuous grasp. He was pleasant to Bonnet, encouraging him to rest in his cabin, easy in the assurance that the sloop was in good hands. They made one capture along the way. The 40-ton sloop Betty of Virginia, loaded with Madeira wine and other merchandise. On September 29th, as they closed on her at the Capes of Virginia, Blackbeard donned his new, terrifying battle attire. He wore a silk sling over his shoulders, to which were attached 3 brace of pistols hanging in holsters like bandoliers. Under his hat, he tied on lit fuses, allowing some of them to dangle down on each side of his face, surrounding it with a halo of smoke and fire. So adorned, a contemporary biographer reported, his eyes naturally looking fierce and wild, that he made altogether such a figure that imagination cannot form an idea of a fury from hell to look more frightful. The crews of merchant ships would take one look at this apparition, surrounded by an army of wild men bearing muskets, cutlasses, and primitive hand grenades, and would invariably surrender without firing a shot. That was exactly what Blackbeard intended. Through terror, he eliminated the need to deplete men and ammunition in battle, and ensured that the vessels he captured remained undamaged, and thus of maximum possible value to his company. The Betty, a humble vessel that regularly worked the wine run from Virginia to Madeira, surrendered, and the pirates looted the best of her cargo. Not wanting to allow her to alert all of Virginia and Maryland to their presence, Blackbeard ordered all the captives brought over to the Revenge. William Howard, his quartermaster, drilled holes in Betty's hull, and as she sank, climbed aboard a rowboat and returned aboard the Revenge. It was now early October, and the Revenge stood off the high sandy capes of Delaware, 5 cannonballs stored alongside each of her guns waiting for prey. The next to run afoul of Blackbeard's men was a heavily loaded merchant ship flying British colors. The ship, it turned out, was just completing the 10 to 12 week journey from Dublin to Philadelphia, with 150 passengers crowded below her decks along with cargo. Almost all of the passengers were indentured servants, and as such were probably in a miserable state. Disease ran rampant in the immigrants' crowded, poorly ventilated quarters, where they faced want of provisions, hunger, thirst, frost, heat, dampness, anxiety, want, affliction, and lamentations, together with lice that abound so frightfully they can be scraped off the bottom. Such passengers would have been desperate to make land. Instead, they found themselves prisoners of a wild man with fire and smoke pouring from his head. Under Hornigold, Blackbeard had conducted himself with restraint, taking only what he needed from the vessels he captured. Now he was free to propose his own agenda to his crew, one far more ambitious than that of his mentor. Hornigold had limited his operations to maritime theft, but in the wake of Bellamy's death, Blackbeard sought to bring as much damage to British commerce as possible, short of the unnecessary taking of human life. He appears to have declared war on the British Empire, using piracy and terror to bring it to its knees. The servants aboard the passenger ship had little to fear from this more radical approach to piracy, but the merchants sailing aboard her had plenty to lose. Like other pirates, Blackbeard's men took what cargo and valuables they fancied, things like coins, jewelry, rum, foodstuffs, ammunition, and navigational instruments. Unlike Hornigold or Bellamy, however, they began dumping the rest of the cargo into the sea. One merchant aboard the ship watched 1,000 pounds of his personal cargo go over the side. He begged to be allowed to keep enough cloth to make just one suit of clothes, but the pirates refused, throwing the last bolt of cloth overboard. By the time they released the ship, its entire cargo had been taken or destroyed. Over the next 2 weeks, Blackbeard brought a tide of terror and destruction to the mid-Atlantic coast, such as had never been seen in peacetime. The Revenge cruised about the Capes of Delaware and the approaches to Bermuda, the Chesapeake, and New York Harbor, never staying more than 48 hours in a single place. They captured vessels coming from all directions, vessels bound for Philadelphia from London, Liverpool, and Madeira, sloops traveling between New York and the West Indies, Pennsylvania merchantmen outbound to England and beyond. Blackbeard took at least 15 vessels in all, and in the process became the most feared pirate in the Americas practically overnight. Traumatized captains poured into New York and Philadelphia bearing tales of woe. Captain Spofford told how, not a day out of Philadelphia, he had been forced to watch Blackbeard's men dump 1,000 barrel staves into the sea and then filled his cargo hold with the terrified crewmen of the Sea Nymph, a snow from Bristol they had captured as it started its journey to Portugal. One of the Sea Nymph's men, the merchant Joseph Richardson, had been very barbarously used by the pirates, suggesting threats and beatings. The pirates had thrown his cargo of wheat into the sea. Captain Peter Peters told how the pirates had seized his sloop, stolen 27 barrels of Madeira wine, hacked away his mast, and left him to run aground. The pirates left Captain Griggs' sloop at anchor at the mouth of the bay, his masts chopped off and his cargo of 30 indentured servants whisked away. The pirates took all the wine from a Virginia-bound sloop before sinking her. Captain Farmer's vessel had already been looted by other pirates on its way from Jamaica, but Blackbeard's men insisted on unrigging his sloop and removing her mast and anchors to serve as spares for the Revenge, before placing 30 servant captives aboard her and leaving her to drift ashore near Sandy Hook, New Jersey. Captain Sipkins was relieved of his command of a great sloop from New York, which Blackbeard's men kept as a consort, mounting her with 13 guns. The swaggering pirates had boasted how they were awaiting their consort, a ship of 30 guns, and that once she arrived, they intended to sail up the Delaware and lay siege to Philadelphia itself. Others bragged that they planned to sail down to the Capes of Virginia to capture a good ship there, which they very much wanted. Blackbeard made a special point of terrorizing those captives from New England, on behalf of the surviving members of Bellamy's crew then rotting in the Boston prison, telling them that if any of their fellow pirates suffer in Boston, that they will revenge it on them. Blackbeard garnered considerable intelligence from his captives. The survivors from Bellamy's wrecks, they learned, were to be tried at any time and likely face the gallows. If Blackbeard intended to rescue them, he was dissuaded by news that King George had ordered a proper force to suppress piracy in the Americas. Two frigates were said to be at Boston, HMS Rose and Squirrel. HMS Phoenix had arrived at New York. And in Virginia, the sixth-rate Lime was now backing up the decrepit Shoreham. One of Blackbeard's captives, Peter Peters, told him that while he was loading his wine at Madeira off the coast of Africa, two Royal Navy frigates had come into the harbor, one en route to New York, the other to Virginia. If they had not arrived already, Peters reported, they soon would be. Blackbeard recognized that the east coast of North America was becoming a risky place for a pirate sloop. It was time to conclude their business and head south to the islands of the Caribbean, indefensible in their multitude, at least until he could gain control of a ship of force. Toward the end of October, Blackbeard's sloop and prizes were spotted sailing along the outside of Long Island, in the direction of Gardner's Island or Block Island. They may have been going to one or the other to pick items left behind by Williams, or perhaps to drop off some of their own treasure. Whatever the reason for their trip, the pirates headed south very soon afterward, sailing for the islands of the Eastern Caribbean. Contrary to many popular accounts, Blackbeard did not return to the Bahamas on his way to the Caribbean, nor is there compelling evidence that he joined forces with Benjamin Hornigold, who appears to have been working his way north at this time in his great sloop, named, confusingly enough, the Bonnet. Blackbeard had so terrorized the coast that his men were ascribed to a number of attacks that he could not possibly have taken part in, as more detailed and credible accounts place him hundreds or thousands of miles away at the time they occurred. Several of these erroneous reports had placed him operating with Hornigold, suggesting that his old mentor may have, in fact, been responsible, but operating with a new consort similar to the Revenge. If so, Hornigold was sailing north while Blackbeard and his men were sailing south, probably well offshore, on their way to the far eastern Caribbean, where the Windward Islands braced themselves against the open Atlantic. Increasing the confusion, Blackbeard was now operating two sloops himself, the Revenge and one of their prizes, a 40-ton Bermuda-built sloop, most likely the vessel taken from Captain Sipkins. This second sloop, which the surviving documents fail to name, now carried 8 guns and some 30 pirates. The larger Revenge had 12 guns and 120 men. Mariners had been conditioned to expect Blackbeard and Hornigold to be operating together, each in their own sloop. Now that each was operating separately, but with two vessels each, It's not surprising that each man's victims wrongly assumed that the other had to be in charge of the second sloop. Like Bellamy before him, Blackbeard was looking to capture a ship of force that would allow his pirate gang to take on even the frigates of the Royal Navy. With two sloops of war at his disposal, the pirates knew they had a reasonably good chance of overwhelming one, and Blackbeard knew just the place to look. Out in the sea, just beyond the arc of the Windward Islands that marks the leading edge of the Caribbean, the transatlantic shipping lanes converged. One could find ships bound from France to Martinique and Guadeloupe, from England to Barbados, and from Spain to the Spanish Main, through the deep water passages between the islands. There, Blackbeard's men decided, was where they would cast their net. It was a good choice. On November 17th, within days or even hours of arriving, the lookout let out a cry. There, on the horizon, were the sails of an approaching ship.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 8.